listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. And today on Write the Book, you're going to hear an interview from the archives with short story writer and guitar builder, Creston Lee. Born and raised in New Hampshire, just across the river from Vermont, Creston Lee attended various schools, including Skidmore College and, as he describes it, the fancy Iowa Writing School. He moved back to Vermont in 1996, worked as a landscaper, carpenter, house mover, barn builder, rock and roll musician, and now custom guitar builder. His stories have appeared in Doubletake, RIP, Open City, Hunger Mountain, and a Norton collection of young writers called 25 and Under Fiction. He currently lives in Burlington with his wife and young son and daughter. There he builds guitars under the name Creston Electronic Instruments. His first collection of stories, Wild Punch, was published in the spring of 2010 by Turtle Point Press. And that's the book that we discussed when I interviewed Creston at the time that the book came out. I began by asking him to talk about how that book, Wild Punch, had started for him.
Well, the stories in this book actually date back a pretty long way. I think the oldest story in this book I wrote when I was about 21 or 22 years old, and a story in there called Hey People. That was, I was still in college. And
that's the one about Junie.
Yeah, right. I wrote that story to use it. I was applying to MFA programs, and that was the story that I sent around. And when I was putting together the collection, I stayed away from this giant stack of stories I'd written when I was basically a teenager. But that one I kept coming back to and still sort of liked, so I worked it over a bit. But yeah, so the stories themselves go back, half a lifetime ago, practically, and most recent, a couple of years old. But the stories came into book form as long ago as maybe 10 years, and I had a couple of those. I now know, and I guess I knew at the back of my, and deep in my heart at the time, sort of typical publishing tales where the publishing house in my dream said they would take it, and then a month later said, we're not going to take it. And then, a year after that, a different house said, well, we'll take it. And then a month after that said, we're not going to take it. Anyone you talk to who's been in the writing business for a while has the same stories, but you're not supposed to let stuff like that get to you. Your artistic drive is supposed to, persevere through all those ups and downs. But honestly, it was fairly crushing. So I stopped. I told my agent to stop shopping the manuscript around, and I just wanted to kind of sit with it and write some more stories, which I did. But then I sort of got into some other things, and I never picked up the phone again and said, how about starting to shop that manuscript around? So I added to it, and then oddly, years went by, and then totally out of the blue, I got an email from Turtle Point Press saying, I heard you might have some stories that I might like, and which has never happened. And then within about 24 hours or so, I had a book contract.
Wow.
That's the reward for some early beating down. You get this sort of a miracle thing fall from the sky. But the stories themselves, span a pretty long amount of time because of that history. A number of them I wrote when I was in graduate school. I went to the writing program in Iowa. I was still pretty young. I think I got there when I was 22 and stayed until I was 24. So, maybe three or four of the stories in here came from that time. And then,
so that was your MFA?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So the book in some ways feels like a this is your life kind of thing to me, spanning between my early 20s and late 30s.
Yeah. Now, we should mention that the book is short stories, but right. they're linked stories.
Yeah, they're not linked like in a sort of necessarily really overt kind of Spoon River sort of way or something, but the characters reemerge and they're all sort of set in the same quasi-real, quasi-imagined town or landscape, more or less. And even the ones that are set elsewhere kind of refer back to that mm-hmm. area. So the geography is really the main connecting piece, and then the characters do kind of come and go from
right.
one story to the next.
Right. So I'm curious, how did the form emerge for you? Is it just that you kept coming back to this area and it was... intriguing to you, and eventually they started to take a larger shape, or did you anticipate a larger form when you started writing these stories?
Well, I think that, you know, the place of the stories just sort of came naturally to me when I started writing. You know, the first time I ever put pen to paper, you know, what do you do? No matter who you are, you refer back to the place that you know best, I guess, or at least that's what came naturally to me. So mm-hmm. I sort of looked to the area of New Hampshire where I grew up, right on the Connecticut River, and set the first thing I ever wrote there. And then in some ways I've never gone beyond that, I guess. You know, in some ways that's arrested development, but in other ways I like setting stories there, and I feel like at this point I've got the version of kind of my hometown mixed with elements from other places that I've combined to make this imaginary place where all these stories are set. And I never sort of set out to associate myself so much with that area, you know, where I left home at 17 and haven't lived there since. But particularly when I went off to the Midwest to go to writing school, I sort of surprised myself by how much I started to, I mean, I missed it certainly, but how much I started to really kind of, you know, associate myself with Northern New England. I guess I always imagined that I would sort of end up in, you know, one of the many cities that people my age were moving to at that area, you know, picking between like San Francisco and Austin, Texas, or wherever else. But after a couple of years in Iowa, I sort of knew that I belonged here, mm-hmm. and that my fiction really sort of belonged here. So anyway, the landscape came first, and then the characters, you know, once you have a small town, there's only so many people right. in the town, so they keep coming back.
I really enjoyed the fact that there was a river splitting these two shores, and that there seemed to be a sort of both a connectivity and a tension between the two sides of the river.
Yeah. And it's an east bank, west bank.
Yeah.
Well, you know, New Hampshire and Vermont are, people think of them as being so totally different from each other, but that area where I grew up, the Upper Valley, the Connecticut River Valley, you know, I was talking to a guy I know who grew up around there, who lives in Burlington now too, and he was saying, you know, I never really thought of myself as being from New Hampshire. You know, I thought of myself as being from Upper New England, you know, because in the course of a day, you're back and forth across the river a million times. So as a young person, you know, who's not necessarily thinking about the politics of the states or anything else, it's just, you know, the river is this constant landmark that you're always crossing and looking at, and you don't really think about the sort of the political map so much as the actual landscape itself.
I really enjoyed, there was one story where your narrator, your main character in the story, basically pulls his car onto the bridge in the middle of the night and turns off his car and just sits there for a while on the bridge in the darkness over the river. And I thought, wow, that's a really neat image of being just in two worlds.
Right.
I enjoyed that. Do you write other forms, longer forms of fiction or poetry?
I messed around a little bit with poetry, but they just turn into, you know, sort of prose poems. You know, some of these stories in this collection are quite short, as you know. There's one that's maybe on a typewritten page is only a page or so long, and some are longer, more like 30 pages. But I never really seriously looked at poetry as something short stories always felt right to me. But I guess I tried to kind of defy this, but it seems like a universal truth that the older writers get, the longer their form gets. You know, when I first started writing fiction, I was really interested in this like two page story. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the newer, this sort of in this book anyway, the newer the story, the longer the story kind of, I don't know if that's entirely true, but it's more or less true. And, you know, I've written longer pieces that aren't in here. But short story always feels right to me. I know you're supposed to graduate up to the novel.
And I don't know.
Picking away that.
Alice Monroe wouldn't agree with you.
Yeah, right. I'd like to follow her course.
You know. Yeah, you could do worse. I'm curious how a story starts for you, and I don't necessarily mean where do you get your ideas, but just if there's any sort of pattern to how it evolves for you from
when. I guess, you know, I've never been very sort of strategic about writing stories. You know, I certainly never, you know, plot out an outline or something like that. And I usually go into it really no, having no idea where it's going to lead and just sort of following instincts through it. But it's, you know, I think writers or any musicians or painters or anything kind of have to have their antenna up for just something that stands out as being kind of exciting or interesting or whatever. So usually just, you know, start with just one, something I saw walking around on the street or read or, you know, who knows, just often that initial thing gets edited out of the story later, but it just starts with the first line, you know, and then I really just sort of follow my nose through it. The thing I like best really about writing fiction is that when I'm working on a story, I feel so in it that almost anything I encounter is kind of like, you know, gets a thumbs up or thumbs down to whether or not it'll find its way into the story. And it's kind of this like supercharged existence of walking around, just being kind of hyper aware of everything. And, you know, it's exciting in a way that, I mean, I do lots of other things, and but nothing else quite matches that feeling of like totally living in a story. Uh-huh. And it's amazing how stuff kind of drifts up from your past into your consciousness as you're writing something, you know, things you've forgotten about that kind of instantly figure in. So it does sort of feel like instincts take over. At the best times,
right,
you know.
When it flows, it's just
Right. I mean, nothing compares to that. So
yeah. How about the endings of your stories? How do you know when you're finished with a piece?
I feel like it usually as I'm getting to that part of the story, I pretty reliably have some sort of revelation about how I want it to end, which is not necessarily even the actual action of the story, but kind of. In my stories, it often is sort of like a mood that I'm trying to hit more than a course of events. You know, when I'm two thirds of the way through or something, something will just feel right to me. Like I'll kind of know what sort of atmosphere I want to create with the ending, and usually I try and leave some of the action of the ending off the page. You know, I sort of take you 90% of the way there, and then leave it a little bit open so that the reader mentally ends the story themselves, to not try and sew it all up entirely. So. That means creating an atmosphere or a mood that enables the reader to kind of take the final step, I guess.
Yeah. I'm wondering, Creston, if maybe this would be a good time for you to read from the book.
Sure.
And we can talk more specifically about it after.
So I'll read the story called Debt that this is the one you mentioned was in Hunger Mountain a couple of years ago. It's the story that the title for the book comes from. Weeks was up in the willow, smoking a camel for a minute. There were two other damaged willows beside the same brook, but they were smaller, and the newer boys would handle them before sundown. As Frank's senior man, it was on him to be up in the tree. Glenn Bushy, who was now the boyfriend of Linda, Weeks' ex-wife, had the tractor. Weeks could see that one of Glenn's eyes was still a little pinched from where he'd hit him with a wild punch a few nights before. Weeks sat in the Y of the huge winter-naked tree, straddling the damaged side of the fork. His pants and chaps rode up on his thighs and pinched off the blood to his dangling legs. He knew better than to shuffle around, trying to get comfortable. That was how saws got dropped, the saw in this case being a big 288 with a 36-inch bar. It belonged to the company, not to Weeks. It had cost Frank $750 on credit on the first day of the ice storm. The job was supposed to pay for the saw, the new tractor tires, payroll. He laid the saw across his thighs and took off his gloves one at a time, blew into each for warmth, and put them back onto his stiff hands. The saw hopped around on his lap as its motor idled. He'd already wrapped the damaged limb with a choke chain and then dropped the free end down to one of the younger boys. The boy hooked the chain to a steel cable, which now cut a tight line through the cold air all the way down to the skid plate on the back of the Blue Ford tractor. To get the right pulling angle, Glenn had pushed the nose of the tractor halfway into the box elder whips at the edge of the woods. The boys stood in a circle beside the tractor, taking turns at breathing in smoke from a brass pipe. Their saws and gas cans and jugs of bar lube were piled together at the base of an undamaged maple. It was the end of the day, gusty, and every so often one of the boys would lean his head down by the hub of the tractor wheel to shield himself from the wind as he passed his lighter over the pipe's bowl. They all had white clouds drifting from their mouths. Glenn was kneeling on the tractor's seat, awkwardly reaching forward over the steering wheel to fit the cuff of his wet glove around the exhaust pipe. It was the best way to warm your gloves if you didn't mind the smell it left on your hands. Weeks hoped Glenn wasn't still mad. He knew Glenn might not pull the lever to engage the winch if all the younger boys' backs were turned. The saw would get pinched under the weight of the big vertical limb. would slow them down until after dark, and then some of them would have to come back the next day to finish. It would spoil the whole job schedule, and Frank would hold it against Weeks, who was supposed to make sure everything ran smoothly. Or the branch could swing back at him where he was trapped if Glenn did his part wrong. But Weeks tried not to think about that possibility. He didn't think his debt went that far. He finished his cigarette and let it fall through the air to the crusty snow. The wind spun it around and then whisked it over the bank into the brook. The short warm spell of the previous few days had broken the ice, and the water ran quickly now, even at its low winter level. Almost every tree had been damaged in the storm. Weeks lifted the saw and worked the trigger a few times. The chain whirled. The long bar leaped with each pull. Down by the edge of the woods, Glenn knelt on the tractor seat. Weeks tried to read his face, but Glenn was giving him a blank stare to make him guess. He turned the saw against the big tree limb and leaned in close to the chain as it cut into the soft wood of the broken tree. The boys down below turned to watch the sawdust spray across his chaps and float away on the wind. Glenn's hand rested on the winch lever. Weeks knew in his heart that Glenn and Linda couldn't last. He might even get another chance with her himself, but that wouldn't last either. It was important they finish the job and move on to the next. Please, he said, over and over and over again.
Thank you very much. Sure. Alex mentioned that was Preston Lee reading from Wild Punch, which was published by Turtle Point Press. I was going to ask you about the chainsaw. Your dad had a chainsaw accident.
Yeah, he
when
did.
He was, in his 40s or something.
Yeah, later, even in his 50s. Yeah, I was. There's a couple of sort of traumatic medical events that happened in my family where I was living in Iowa at that time, and my sister got in a bad car accident around the same time, and it's, because I was sort of far away, I didn't hear about it until a few days later, where I got a phone call saying, everything's okay, your dad's on morphine in the hospital, but he almost cut his leg off. But yeah, he was helping out a neighbor who was in rough shape and slipped while he was cutting up wood, and I fell onto the chainsaw blade and cut right through his thigh. It was pretty rough, but
yeah.
He's written more eloquently about that
And I should mention that your father is Sidney Lee,
who's
poet and prose writer. Well, Wild Punch is written through the points of view of a number of different characters, and some of them are Russell, Junie, Pepsi, Dean, Carlton, Karen. I was curious if you feel any one of these characters has more in common with your worldview than any of the others.
That's a good question. All the characters in this book bear no resemblance to any person living or dead, right? So it says that, so I guess I'd be careful. But, there's that story in there called Knowledge, where there's a character named Carlton, who's sort of the main character in that one, who's dealing with a friend's suicide. And that story I wrote, in pretty similar circumstances and in my own life. And, I can't say that he's me or vice versa.
Right.
Maybe that one sort of feels closer to home than some of the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'd like to think that I'm able to step outside myself a little bit to write these, but I also can find myself in all of them. In fact, my wife actually helped me a lot in editing this collection. She made me realize how much the characters in the story are kind of, even if they're dealing with other people, that they're sort of all, they all have a sort of an air of isolation about them in a way, and she read through the manuscript for the first time in a while, and she said, are you okay? I feel so cut off from everybody. I guess I'll spare the parlor psychology, but that's something I hadn't really realized about my own writing or about my own characters, is that they're kind of, alone and in the company of others sometimes.
That's interesting. So, I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about the story that's called Black Flies.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed that story. It's the second story in the collection. I found it very interesting structurally.
Mm-hmm.
The timeline of Black Flies is not straightforward or backward, and I think it flows very organically, but it's not organized in a chronological manner. So I'm just curious if you could talk about the structure of that story.
Yeah, it's funny. In some ways, that was almost the first part of that story. I don't know. Somehow that, it sort of starts at point A and goes to point B, and then kind of goes back to some non-existent letter before A, and then kind of skips back to B in some way. The same moment the story happens twice.
Yes.
Sometimes my stories are shaped by songs. I play music, and I've always cared a lot about music, so I can't point to a particular tune or something that made that happen, but I can point to other stories where the shape of a song is sort of burrowed into my brain and it's reemerged as a story.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
But somehow I just I guess I kind of wanted to see if I could pull that off. And I remember talking to somebody when I was writing that story, and they're asking what I was up to, and I said, I'm trying to write the story where it, kind of starts here and then goes back there and then comes back and does this again. And it's unlike me to start with a form, but I think that one really, really did.
I'm going to stick with that story for a minute. Toward the middle of it, the characters, Jeffrey, and is it Russell?
I don't think the character in that story is named.
I don't think he's named. Yeah. Okay. So, two characters are in the barn. All the lights are out because there's a horse that has an infected eye, among other problems. And so they have the lights out to help this horse. And I began to get this incredible sense of foreboding. Do you mind if I just read a couple of lines of dialogue? I nailed the blue blanket over the window and made it dark. Jeffrey went into Esau's stall. I heard the horse blow, stamp, turn. You better leave him alone, I said. He's all nervous. I won't hurt him. Yeah, well, he can't see you at all. Me either, he said. I can hardly see anything. We went back into the light and drove my father's Ford into town. And then the story goes on. There's just this moment in that darkness that I felt very foreboding. Did you intend that, or is that just what I took from it?
No, I mean, I guess the condition of that poor horse in that story sort of is worse than it seems at first. But I guess, without giving too much away, the horse's problem seems to be one thing, and then kind of later it turns out to be something else. And I guess I liked hearkening towards that or making it more tense.
I wanted to talk about your details. You always seem to have the perfect details to describe the moment. I was just going to mention two examples. First, there's Ivy, who's treating Esau, that sick horse, and the narrator says she smelled like the molasses they put in the grain. I love that because, my sister was a horse person, and I wasn't, but I grew up around barns because she was taking care of her horse. I never even knew they put molasses in grain, and I hadn't thought about that smell in forever, and I read that detail, and I was like, oh my God, it's molasses. Anyway, I thought it was perfect. And the other one was, the whole book is filled with these, but another one that struck me was, I heard him dialing the old wall mount phone, trying to force the slow dial back faster than it wanted to go. And that just, actually that made me a little bit sad because I thought, my kids wouldn't even know what that means.
Right, right.
But then there's also significant detail, which is a little bit different. And an example, again, from Black Flies, he's talking about Jeffrey. He was sitting in the driver's seat wearing his old high school basketball jersey to show off the new tattoo. And the tattoo becomes important. Mm-hmm. And at the moment that you read it, that's the first you've heard about it. And the word "the new tattoo" sort of set it aside as something important. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your descriptions and the frame of mind that you're in when you're looking for the right detail.
Yeah, I've always been a little bit shy of sort of, I guess at its worst, having, Johnny looked in the mirror and saw his, raven black hair and stubbly chin or physical description. I usually kind of stay away from describing characters almost universally or giving too much kind of backstory. Let's harken back to this earlier episode in someone's life so we can fully understand what's happening in the time of the story. I guess I just sort of naturally like for the character to emerge through the details, so...
Do you take notes? Do you carry a notebook around with you?
No, I guess I sort of would mean to. I have the greatest idea I ever had and know that I should have a little pad in my pocket and write it down, but I don't. Something really seems like, that I lose the piece of paper. So I don't refer back to stuff like that. Usually it's, if one of those things is really sort of powerful enough, that becomes the catalyst for a new story. And then I sort of, as I said, once I'm working on something, everything I encounter sort of seems, if I think of something else that seems really great, that will sort of alter the shape of the story or the course of the action of the story. But I don't, it's one of those things that I kind of wish that I did, but I guess at this point, I feel like that's just how I operate.
Yeah. What you just said reminded me actually of something that you wrote in here. Let me see if I can find it. I know if you look hard enough for something that isn't there, you're probably going to see it anyway. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit different. But if you're presently focused on a certain subject, you're going to see it everywhere and probably notice details that really apply to it.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like I remember every single moment of life up until, 15 years ago, and now I don't remember what happened yesterday. Or, I feel like there's something about that landscape where I grew up and the town where I grew up where, still if I go back there and I just drive around for an hour, everything I look at, it seems to have a story in it.
How do you approach revision, Preston?
I, if anything, I'm guilty probably of revising too much, spending too much time reworking an old story rather than plotting a new one, And the way that this book happened, that I was picking up a lot of stories I hadn't looked at in a long time, was actually very freeing when it came to revision. And I remember the parts that I kind of agonized the most over or sort of held to be most precious an old story, so it was very easy to just cut them out with an axe and start over. So to honestly answer your question, I approach revision by just reading the story over and over and over again. And some of these stories I've read 1,000 times, literally. And, with every reading, change at least something, if nothing else.
Do you tend to revise as you start a first draft? Like, do you go back and read page 2 when you're on page 3?
I try and sort of get the story on paper, I guess, and then I tinker with it for years. I guess I go back and read just to sort of catch myself up to the moment where I am, but I don't do that methodically. I don't, when I sit down to write that day, I try and just go, but then every now and then it's sort of fun to go back. I mean, it's exciting, when you see like, look at all the stuff I invented, so I go back and read it more because it's fun to do than to, I don't want to make too many, it's rare for me to like sort of go back and really change the direction of the story or something. I try and sort of see it through with the initial vision and then go back, and if big changes need to happen, then I can do it then.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, when you're hanging around at writing schools or with young writers especially, I guess, or people who are new to writing, there's all these kind of maxims about how you're supposed to do this and how you're supposed to do that. And I remember someone saying, I can't remember which, legendary writer was probably misquoted as saying, the first thing you should do is take all your stories and put them in a drawer for 10 years, or 5 years or a year or whatever, I remember hearing that very well because, first of all, it seemed kind of like didn't really ring true. But it also, historically true that somebody would actually have said that. But it just seemed impossible. I was in my mid-20s and really sort of ambitious and really eager to get a book out. And the idea of shelving something was just unthinkable. But as fate had it, I did exactly that. Some of those stories sat unread for a long, long time. So I can tell you that it's actually great advice, if you can make yourself finish something that you're really excited about and then just put it away and not look at it for years, it's, the revision is much easier with all those years of distance. So
if it still excites you when you get back to the material.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if it's junk, I guess that's just depressing.
Well,
but if you go back and you're like, wow, this is actually better than I thought.
I wouldn't think a week is enough time, but 2 months might still be enough time. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think stories that I've revised, dozens or hundreds of times after a break of, a year or several years, five or in some cases maybe as much as 8 or 9 years, revision became much more efficient and expedient. I could really easily identify the parts where I was imitating somebody else or I was trying too hard or wasn't really being true to myself.
Right.
Those things were like leapt off the page at me as like, hugely embarrassing and were very easy to cross out with a pen. So some of these stories changed quite a lot between the acceptance, between Turtle Point actually offering the contract and going to press. And some of the stories were the older ones where I really overhauled the cut out characters or, really, really changed them into different stories. Mm-hmm. And in one case in particular, a story in here called 4 Miles Out that I really wrestled with, which is an older story. I mean, that story's been revised so many zillions of times, and I realized after I finally finished and I felt really good about it that it, in some ways it had actually come back through all those revisions to being very similar to how it was when I first wrote it, 15 years ago. The characters were different, a different number of characters, but sort of the shape of the story and the ending in particular was very similar to the very first draft, which I'd sort of long forgotten about, but I realized sort of happily that, maybe the first vision was the truest one.
That's neat.
Yeah.
How significant would you say it was in your evolution as a writer to be Sidney Lee's son?
If nothing else, I grew up with a lot of books around, and both my parents really were my mom actually maybe was more ardent about pushing particular titles on me, you know, but I grew up in a house with a lot of books. Didn't have to be told to believe that books were sort of a higher level of entertainment than TV or sports or anything else. So I always held books to be sacred, which is something that other writer friends, you know, their parents didn't feel that way. So that alone is a real gift.
Is your mom a writer as well?
She's not in the same way, you know, but takes writing seriously. And, so I never, like a lot of teenage boys, had a lot of attention with my dad growing up, but I never, you know, when it's inescapable that he was a model for me from a young age, to, you know, that being a writer was a possibility. Some people that, you know, could never occur to them, but there was a blueprint right there. I never had to convince my parents that it was worth doing, you know. I didn't have them breathing down my neck that I should go to law school or something. So that alone was, you know, made life easier, I'm sure. But I also, I'm happy to say, you know, really enjoy my dad's writing. I think he's really incredibly talented. And you know, he's written a novel, and he's actually a really good short story writer. He hasn't published terribly many of those, but the couple I've read I've really liked. And his essays, I think, are great. But his prose poems, I think, actually were fairly influential to me. Poetry gets sort of a bad rap, I think, among people who don't really know it or read it as being too obtuse or inaccessible or something. And frankly, much of it is, you know. But, you know, I think he really believes that the writing should be accessible, you know, and never intentionally make something kind of obscure, or doesn't diminish his craft, you know. If anything, I really admire and respect him for that. So it was easy for me as a short story writer to read his poems, and particularly some of his prose poems, and take those as influential in the same way that reading, you know, a short story writer who I never met, you know, those are important to me. And he's been a good critic for me. You know, it was sort of scary for me to show him stories early on, and he's always been very supportive of my writing, but also if he has a problem with something, you know, he'll really say so. I think he also kind of kept me from wandering into goofiness here and there. You know, I think he never sort of sat me down and gave me a lecture about writing. I mean, not at all. I understood accessibility to be important from the beginning, and I think that comes from him.
Yeah. I'm curious, when you read his work for the first time, did you read it when you were a kid or not until you were older?
Well, you know, an early book of his was dedicated to me, so like that was pretty exciting. So I'd bring it to school, you know, and show people that my name was in a book, you know. Or there was a haiku I wrote for maybe a third or fourth grade assignment about this dilapidated barn across the road from where we grew up that he published. That was the front piece of one of his collections of poems. So that was, you know, likewise, I could take it in and show it to my friends at school. So I had it around, you know, and I read it before I understood it. But I think he wrote a novel in the late 80s. That was quick. I remember reading it on an airplane and sort of hoping somebody would ask me about it so I could say it's my dad, you know, that kind of thing. Much in the same way that I'd be excited to see somebody, you know, I've seen people carrying this book around, and it's been sort of wanting to go over and be like,
That's me.
But that novel's really good, and I think, you know, then I started going back and reading the poems, kind of, you know. I mean, I was only 17 or so at the time, but I started kind of really delving into his work as a reader more than as his, you know, as his kid from that point on. So, but he's really good.
Well, I want to mention your work in music. You're a musician. You also build electric guitars.
Right.
This is from your website. Creston Electric Instruments produces custom guitars built one at a time by one person near the old barge canal in beautiful Burlington, Vermont. The guitars are finished to look like real instruments made by a real person, not poured out of a mold on the other side of the globe. All custom guitars are designed in collaboration with the players who use them, professionals and beginners and in between. So that's a very interesting line of work to go into. How did you start doing that?
Well, you know, accidentally, but when I moved to Burlington, I came straight from the writing school in Iowa here, and I sort of half-heartedly looked around for work related to the degree I just received, you know, editing or teaching, and struck out pretty quickly and fell into doing carpentry work and sort of thing I'd done, you know, in summers before. So I was kind of working with wood, and I'd been playing guitar just barely, you know, for a few years. It was one of those things that I'd grown up, you know, having to take trumpet and saxophone lessons and never really liked it very much, and I picked up a guitar, you know, everyone plays guitar, you know, so I thought I could just sort of decided I wouldn't take lessons, and I'd have one lying around, and it would sort of be something I could lean in the corner, and I would allow myself to take it very seriously, because I was so serious about writing, you know, and then I moved to town, and couldn't find writing-related work, and started working with wood in one capacity or another, and met a lot of musicians here. I'd always had musicians friends that had always been such an admirer of music, but it was something like, you know, that they did and I couldn't do. And then next thing you know, I started playing in bands here, and the next thing you know, it kind of took over my life. So there's this sort of noble idea of the artists being so single-minded that, you know, that they'll do, by any means necessary, they're doing their writing or their painting, whatever. So it took me a while to kind of make peace with myself that it was okay, that I was, you know, interested in playing music, and that it wasn't, I wasn't somehow neglecting my true art of writing. But the fact is, I fell into playing quite a lot of music, 50 shows a year, 100 shows a year, something like that.
Wow.
Like really, really very busy for it. A little bit less now than I was for a number of years, but the carpentry stuff had developed more into slightly finer woodworking stuff and cabinetry and that kind of thing. And meanwhile, I was playing more and more guitar, and then I had this kind of revelatory moment. the two just collided, and then I built myself a guitar, and then built a couple of guitars for friends around here, and then it sort of all by itself turned into like an overnight sensation kind of thing, where I've been really busy with it ever since.
Mm.
and quit doing the carpentry stuff, which I never liked very much at all, to say the least, and got into building guitars, which I love.
Now, do you have a storefront somewhere?
I don't have a storefront. I have a sort of a secret shop in town where I make around 50 guitars a year. And
so you just encourage people to find you on your website?
Yeah, well, luckily it's been a word of mouth kind of thing where I don't advertise them, but it feels fairly established now and self-perpetuating. So every time I make one, you know, a couple more people see that one and get interested. So they're literally in every corner of the globe now, and all over the country. So it's something I would have never dreamed was possible.
Right.
But
some of them have like some beautiful painted artwork
on
them.
The cover of this book is the part of the cover is a detail from a friend of mine named Sarah Ryan, who's an artist around here, hand paints. Yeah. So I mean, actually the design of this book is I'm incredibly happy with, and it's exciting for me that some element of the guitar stuff found its way onto the book, because those two parts of my life feel really separate from each other in many ways. So it's kind of nice to see them come together here in the book design. I mean, the book design in general is one of my favorite things about this whole collection.
It's wonderful.
Beautifully done, yeah.
It's so beautifully done. It's not just even the cover, which is beautiful, but the inside of the book, in between each story, is a black page with the title of the next story in white.
Mm-hmm.
It's this fat. I mean, I was always able to find my place.
Yeah, right.
Because of the pages marking in between. It was beautiful.
Well, I think, you know, one of the real pleasures of being with Turtle Point Press is the book design. You know, I've had a lot of friends who've, you know, so excited to sell their first book, and then they're so unhappy with the cover, and they have to live with it for the rest of their lives. And I don't know, you know, at a different publishing house or a bigger publishing house, if I would have had so much say. You know, the guy who designed the book, Jeff Clark, is a friend of mine, and, you know, we went through like 60 different covers or something. You know, some of them subtle variations on the final one, but a very different experience than that of friends of mine who've sort of been arm wrestled into settling for something they didn't like. So, so I'm incredibly grateful for that, and really pleased with the final product.
Yeah. I want to go back to writing for our last couple questions, or reading actually. What sorts of books do you enjoy reading?
I still really like reading short stories, even though, you know, everyone in the publishing industry tells you no one ever reads them. But I love them very much, and I guess I sometimes fall into a closed loop of reading the same handful of writers over and over again. I'm not very aggressive about seeking out new stuff. But what can I say? You know, there's a handful of stories or books that I like so much that I kind of go back to them, like, you know, like a religious person reads the Bible or something.
Who would be some of your favorites?
I really like Larry Brown, who died a few years ago. When I first got to Iowa, I had the writer Tom Jones as a teacher. His collection of stories, I think, are really pretty incredible, too. His book, The Pugilist of the Rest, had just come out. And that, you know, I would point to that as one of my favorite collections. But he turned me on to the to Larry Brown's books, and I immediately fell in love with those. And then I just happened to meet somebody else who was living in Iowa City at the time, who happened to be from Oxford, Mississippi, nearby where Larry was from, and said, "Oh, have you read this guy Larry Brown? I just discovered him, and I love him so much." And she quickly ran and found a piece of paper and wrote down his address and said, "You should write him a letter. He really needs to hear that." And so I did. I'm not really in the habit of writing fan letters to writers, but I did. And then he and I developed a correspondence for a while.
That's great.
So I feel sort of I feel sort of possessive of him. I feel like in rock and roll circles, he sort of became a darling of that world too. And in some ways, I was a little jealous of that, but which is ridiculous. I'm so happy that people recognize how great he was. But he died maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah. And,
for a guy who I never met him, but really, that's the most affecting loss of a pen pal I've ever had. But so I love his books, fiction and nonfiction. Speaking of great now dead Southern writers, I really like Barry Hanna's short stories. I've just been rereading his book Airships, which was one of the first books that of stories I read that when I was interested in writing fiction myself, that really seemed like I had to go like take a walk or something after I read some of the stories because they just seemed so great. I love Robert Stone's short stories. He just published a new book of short stories that's like, for me that's like, I don't know, peace in the Middle East or like a cure for like a plague or something. You know, it's like everything else just seems like in the way. I can't wait to start reading that book of stories. But his stories, his language is so straight. I mean, sometimes I don't know if you know those stories, but his characters tend to like drugs and stuff. So there's a lot of kind of fringy things happening, or sometimes things get a little surreal. But the language is so totally straightforward that's always like a nice lesson for me that. You can kind of write about anything in this very unadorned language, and it's sort of made more powerful by how pared down it is,
Is it sort of unemotional like Raymond Carver, or is it...
Yeah, but it's not mannered like Raymond Carver is, It's just much more just sort of plain language.
Okay.
So, but I think he had a, he finally published a collection of stories that appeared in the New Yorker and other places for years and years called Bear and His Daughter that... I really love. There's some stories in there that I think are among the best stories I've ever read. Some of his novels, too. One, A Flag for Sunrise, I think is really one of my favorite books. Richard Ford's stories, the book Rock Springs, I just reread that recently because I think that's really a pretty incredible book. So, I guess if there's a common thing there, aside from them all being men, which I guess I'm a little self-conscious of, they tend to be a sort of plain language that I really like. And I think, if anything, in revision of my own stories, I tried to trim out stuff that seemed kind of like self-consciously not flowery, but kind of, I could tell I was trying to be writerly or something,
Yeah.
Because I think, all that does is sort of pull your attention away from the story.
Right.
You start actually noticing the print on the page rather than whatever lies beyond that. I guess I add Tobias Wolff to that list, too.
Hmm. One of my favorite stories of all times is Tobias Wolff's Bullet in the Brain.
Oh, yeah,
that, where did that come from? I just love that story.
Yeah, that he sort of keeps resurfacing in my life because I was thinking, actually, in anticipation of talking to you, kind of when I got interested in writing and if I had sort of a lightning striking kind of moment. And I didn't, but I did have a year, which in retrospect sort of has mattered a lot in my life, much more than I realized at the time, where I did a fifth year of high school after, I was a pretty lousy student through high school in New Hampshire, and I was bound for art school, actually, in Philadelphia, and at the last second had a change of heart and didn't want to do that, so I went to this prep school in Pennsylvania called the Hill School, which I think at one point was sort of like a top flight school, but all the others had gone co-ed, and this one hadn't, and I think it sort of suffered as a result, and it was in less of a picturesque setting in kind of a factory town in eastern Pennsylvania, but I didn't have a lot of friends there, and it was kind of a lonely year. But a couple of things happened there that I think really ended up changing my interest away from fine arts into and directed me towards writing and reading. Really, one was that there's nothing to do. I was stuck on campus, and for the first time in my life, I got really interested in academics, and particularly my English classes, and I'd always sort of thought of myself as a dumb kid, you know, but I sort of got really interested in reading, thanks mostly to one teacher there, but...
you got to say the teacher's name. Go ahead.
His name was Mr. Gachet, okay. who comes up later, and I'll tell you why, people started thinking I was kind of smart, which was a new experience for me, and I've always done well with a little encouragement, so I just really was eating up the study of literature, which, you know, I'd liked English classes in high school before, but I hadn't really devoured it the way I did. Someday I was really interested in reading and writing about reading and writing my books. But also, Tobias Wolff famously lied his way into that school, which is chronicled in This Boy's Life.
And Life took place there.
Right, so he, it takes place mostly in Oregon, I guess, but I think towards the end of that book, he forges his transcripts and writes his own letters of recommendation and gets in. So I'd never heard of him before, you know, but he came and read. He must have just had a book out. So he came and read, and it was the first time that I'd known writers, my father's friends, you know, there's writers around the house when I was a kid, but I thought of them as being my dad's friends. I never paid any particular attention to them as writers, but here was a guy who came to this school of 500 boys who, you know, normally couldn't sit still for anything, and he was really great, and it was, you know, there's something about that moment that I sort of became interested in him, and he came to a history class that I was in at the time, and so I got to meet him and talk to him a little bit, and still didn't read anything of his, I think, for years to come. But later discovered him as a short story writer in particular. I like all his books, actually, quite a lot, but his stories are great. But maybe the most significant thing that happened there was I had a roommate from Spain, and we lived in this tiny little room, but the way the modular furniture was arranged, when I was on my side of the room and he was on his side of the room, we didn't actually see each other, and his English wasn't that great, and somehow we made it through the whole year without ever even having a conversation, despite living practically on top of each other. You know, we'd both go away as often as we could on weekends, and then so on Monday morning or Sunday night, say, you know, how was your weekend? Great. And then we'd talk to him again until the next Sunday. It was very peculiar, but anyway, when he left at the end of the year, he was going back to Spain, and he abandoned a lot of his possessions. And one of those possessions was a book by a guy named Pinckney Benedict, who was an alumnus of that school and had gone off to Princeton, where I think he'd worked with Joyce Carol Oates, and he had just published this collection, University Press, University of Ontario Press, I think, of stories that were all set in his native West Virginia. And this guy, Mr. Gachet, had taken the photo on the cover because they'd been classmates. But he was maybe only 24 or 25 at the time. And something, there's all these books lying around. For some reason, I just picked up that book and I took it home with me and read it over the summer. And that was maybe like, that was probably the first thing I read that really felt like, not only do I love these stories, but this all sort of feels familiar to me in a way. And this is like, this is something I want to write, you know, I want to write stories like these stories. I'd gone from kind of just love. I mean, I always read books my whole life. You know, I always cared about reading. And
his name again was?
Pinckney Benedict.
Pinckney.
Yeah. And he's published a couple. He's published a novel and then a second collection of stories. The second collection of stories is quite good too, but there's something really kind of special about that first one. And he hasn't published a book, as far as I know, in many years, but that book really meant a lot to me early on. You know, if I had a revelatory moment, it was probably reading that collection of stories. I mean, and I haven't read it now for a number of years, but I still can remember lots of details from those stories as though I read them this morning, you know.
Oh, that's right.
I think they were the blueprint.
What was the name of the collection? Do you remember?
Town Smokes, okay. Which refers to store-bought cigarettes as opposed to kind of you roll at home.
Well, great. I just have one last question. What do you do when you get stuck in your work?
I don't know. I abandon it and go make guitars for a few years, I guess. But I don't know. You know, as I said earlier, you know, people have all these kind of magic formulas for, like, if you follow these three steps, you'll suddenly be able to write. And I none of those things ever really meant much to me. But the best advice I ever got, and I kind of wish that I could follow it more faithfully, was from a friend of mine named Rick Harsh at writing school, who, you know, he wrote something like five novels in the time that it took me to write three stories. And his daily practice was to write 100 words, which is, you know, about a paragraph. And the thinking is that if that's if that's your ambition for the day, you know, the bar is pretty low. So you can always get, no matter how bad of a day you're having or how brain dead you feel, you know, you can still make 100 words go onto the page. And, you know, if things go well, then you keep writing and maybe you get 10 pages, who knows. But what it does is it gets you to put pen to paper every day, and with a pretty unambitious goal. So, you know, I'd be with him somewhere, and he'd get sort of bored, and I'd see him scribbling in a notebook, and he'd be like, well, I've written 100 words, so now I'm going to go off to the bar or something, you know. Like, that was fine. Like, if he only got 100 words, he'd done his work for the day. But, I mean, he's written, like, a zillion books, you know, just with that as his daily practice. So,
do you know if he still writes?
Yeah, he lives in Slovenia, and he published a trilogy of books that are really good, that I think all of which he wrote in about 3 months, you know, when we were in school together. So,
wow.
So that's the only piece of kind of, you know, I heard lots of other things, but
that's great, because, you know, a lot of people say write every day, but yeah. I think actually the low bar is helpful.
Absolutely. I mean, I heard variations of that, like, you know, 4 pages a day or 1,000 words a day, but it's really just most important that you actually try to do something every day. So, which I do not, you know, so if I had, this wouldn't be my first collection, it'd be my fifth, but that's the only piece of kind of writing advice like that that I ever actually thought was really smart.
I think it's useful. Yeah. So, well, thank you so much for talking.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Creston Lee. We spoke quite a bit about his father during that interview. I just want to mention that his dad is Sidney Lee, and he is now Vermont's poet laureate. You can read more about Creston Lee's work at his website, CrestonGuitars.com, and on that website he also has a link to another website that's got some more to do about Wild Punch and his writing. So the last time I broadcast this interview with Creston Lee, I used his suggestion for a write the book prompt, which was to eavesdrop on a conversation in a public place and then use what you overhear to write a scene that has dialogue in it, which is a great prompt, but I do try not to repeat them. So this time I'll recommend something a little bit different but also useful in writing dialogue. And that is to use a digital recorder or a tape recorder or a dictaphone or something and record a conversation between two people. Probably you're going to have to ask them if you can do it. And then maybe try to do it when they're not expecting it after they've said that you can, so that it's natural. Record a conversation between two people and then transcribe the conversation exactly as it occurred. Write down every pause, every stutter, and repetition. Now study a page of dialogue in a book that's well written, a book that you like, and decide what might differ in the way that conversation actually sounds from the way that it is best represented on the page. What would you do to the conversation you transcribed to make it a better piece of writing? What would you take out? What would you add? What might you change? See if you can turn the conversation that you recorded into a scene that would be understandable, effortless for a reader to digest. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. I have a favor to ask of my listeners. Write the Book used to have a Facebook group, and unfortunately with the transition to Facebook's new look, all of the data about the Write the Book Facebook group was lost. All the people who had ever signed up to get notifications, I don't have their emails anymore. And now the show has a Facebook page, which is different than a group, and we'd like more people to be able to find us. So if you're a Facebook user and you're not adverse to liking pages and you are a listener of the show, please go to Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook and like us, and then you'll see information about upcoming shows and other random posts. Not too many, because everyone knows too many posts becomes quickly annoying. Thank you for your support and for liking Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And finally, do remember that this station is all volunteer. It's here thanks to community support and involvement. And more information about getting involved at The Radiator, either to do a show or to volunteer behind the scenes or whatever else you might be interested in helping with, you can get more information online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.